Is there life elsewhere in the universe? And if there is, how would we know it's out there? That's the life's work of my guest today, Adam Frank, alongside a growing community of scientists engaged in the search for astrobiology. It's a field that can seem like science fiction, and indeed it was a few decades ago. But now there's been a series of revolutions that have upended the field and suddenly shifted this science fiction increasingly towards science fact. That's what we're going to talk about in the Securities Podcast episode today. Joining me is Luxa scientist in resident Sam Arbsman, and the three of us are going to talk about the trilogy of revolutions that have suddenly opened up astrobiology to broad study. We talk about the search for biosignatures and technosignatures that might indicate life on other worlds, and how programs like SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, as well as the Habitable Worlds Observatory Telescope, will one day open the aperture even further. And inevitably, we talk about how artificial intelligence has completely transformed this field, by allowing scientists to construct and analyze more data than ever before. We end with a question to Adam on when he predicts alien life to be found, but first up, let's dive in with some background on astrobiology. Just to get the conversation underway, I mean, we mentioned the Drake equation, which to me, in some ways, was this like completely theoretical, off-the-shelf notion from Drake, who was like, how many alien species could there be? And there's like some factors you can kind of vent. You can think in your head as a thought experiment. There's some triggers. How many planets are there? How many of them might have the ability to support life? And he puts this all together into a formula that in some ways you could imagine was never going to be empirically provable in any way, shape, or form. But my understanding from your book and the work that you've done, we've actually made a lot of progress over the decades from a total theory, pie in the sky, science fiction. And we always like this term at Lux Capital of, you know, from science fiction to science fact. But we've actually taken some of the big fiction in this world and made it a little bit more factual over the years. So I'm curious, when you think about the evolution of the field and the work that you've done, what's changed? What's sort of the vanguard today in 2024?
Well, I like to think when it comes to, you know, what's changed with astrobiology, I like to think of the three revolutions in astrobiology. The first one is the most important one, which is the discovery of exoplanets. You know, when I was a graduate student back in the 80s, or late 80s and 90s, early 90s, no one knew whether there were any planets orbiting any stars other than the eight we had orbiting the sun, right? And there's the history. If you look at the history, there are a number of prominent astronomers who ended their careers by claiming to have found an exoplanet and then holding on to that even while it was clear that they were wrong, right? And then in 1995, and I remember this day, the first exoplanet is discovered, is announced. It was weird. That was important, right? It was a Jupiter-sized world that was on like this super tight orbit around a star, like a four-day orbit. It was closer to its star than Mercury is to the sun. So from that point, from 1995 on, you see slowly the number of exoplanets increasing until then you get the Kepler satellite. And then suddenly, boom, you're starting to get thousands discovered, wholesale. And now we know that every planet in the sky has, or every star, excuse me, every star in the sky has planets. So right there, like suddenly, you know, since we believe that planets are necessary for life, suddenly the odds just exploded that you could, you know, that you could get life in the universe. Second revolution is the solar system. We have now sent probes to every kind of, pretty much every planet and every kind of body in the solar system, which means we understand the history of planets so much more, in so much more detail when it comes to like their climate and their evolution and how planets evolve, whether they have plate tectonics, whether they have magnetic fields. You know, we've had boots on the ground or wheels on the ground, landing pads on the ground on all these different worlds, which have really given us an understanding of the diversity of planetary environments. And then the third revolution is Earth's own history. You know, we have basically peeled back, you know, there's still lots of questions, but we've peeled back the entire history of the Earth, in particular, the 3.8 or so billion year history of life and the Earth, the coupled evolution of life and the planet. And what that has shown us is that Earth has been many worlds across its history. It's been a water world, a jungle world, an ice world, and many times some of the most important transitions in the functioning of the planet came because of life, because life changed it. So it's the Earth didn't just evolve by itself. The biosphere and what we call the geospheres, you know, the atmosphere, the cryosphere, the hydrosphere, the lithosphere, those have been evolving together right? So what that tells you, if Earth is, you know, a good guide, is that life hijacks a planet and completely alters its evolution. So the whole game has changed. And that's what the point of the book is that astrobiology, which used to be, there was no astrobiology, you know, NASA called it exobiology for a while. There really was never a lot of funding for it. It was not a principal concern for astronomers. Now it is, in some sense, it's the most exciting field. And you can tell that because the next giant telescope we're building, the successor to the James Webb Space Telescope, has a name. You know, it's going to take 20 years, but it has a name. It's called the Habitable Worlds Observatory, right? And that tells you right there what the principal, you know, this is the flagship telescope we're building. The principal concern of that telescope, it'll do other things, but the principal concern is going to be to find life.
The fact that there's now this interest in intelligent life, and is some of it kind of this like almost like a branding exercise of like talking about technosignatures versus like SETI or things like that? Like, do you have a sense of what kind of precipitated making that more acceptable? Or was it the kind of thing of, okay, we're already doing astrobiology, so this is therefore the logical next step is to kind of move from dumb life to intelligent life?
I think, you know, for people in the field, you know, I'm still relatively new to the field. Like, my career was not in SETI. I didn't work in SETI. And the classic radio SETI, the things like the pioneers and heroes of the field, like Frank Drake and Carl Sagan, and, you know, more recently, Jill Tarter, you know, amazing hero. You know, they were still using what I would call classic SETI, where you're using radio telescopes. And often in that classic search, you were looking for beacons. You were, you know, the idea was somebody was setting up a beacon, you know, purposely sending you a message. I always found that that's one of the reasons I didn't go in, you know, didn't spend a lot of time in SETI, because it was too much of, well, they know that we know that they know that we know. So that's classic SETI. What really changed, I think, over the last, since the exoplanet revolution, is now you know exactly where to look. Like, Frank Drake didn't know where to look. He just pointed the telescope at a sun-like star. Now we know exactly which stars not only have planets, but have habitable zone planets, have planets in the right place for life to form, meaning that if you poured, you know, a cup of water out on the ground, it would stay liquid. It wouldn't boil away and it wouldn't freeze. And so that means the way we're searching for life, whether it's dumb or smart life, has changed utterly. It's this thing called atmospheric characterization, which I can talk about. But I think that is really what people normally think about when they think about SETI is they're thinking about something that's still, there's still lots of great work to be done on it. It's gone beyond just looking for beacons. You know, you can use machine learning to look for non-natural signals. So that's great. But it's just that the field has expanded so much beyond that. That's only one tool in the toolbox. We've had to really that's the mission, is to broaden past that kind of, you know, 1960s European vision of what a civilization is. Because, you know, we have no idea what a civilization looks like other than it uses energy to do work. So I think that's why for me, SETI, I'm cool if people want to use it, but I think the real thing is technosignatures. What we're looking for are signatures of technology, right? Not intelligence, technology. Because that's what we're, you know, we're not going to find a, you know, a poem. What we're going to do is we're going to find evidence, evidence of using energy to do work for the purpose of a civilization.
So related to that, though, there's a lot of different ways, yeah, civilizations can do their things. And I feel like there's like historically been a lot of times in astronomy where people have discovered certain objects or phenomena and thought, okay, maybe this is due to intelligent life. So I believe like pulsars are kind of like one example of that. Yeah. And then we kind of learn, okay, yeah, it's a natural phenomenon. Obviously, in the course of doing that, we learned a lot about the universe, but how do you think about like what is the kind of like threshold for evidence for these kinds of technosignatures?
You know, what's interesting is the whole field, biosignatures and technosignatures, has gone through this maturation. That's what's really fascinating. Once there's funding, means so that you can have a community of people who are talking to each other, having a long conversation. Somebody proposes a biosignature, technosignature, and then somebody writes a paper which criticizes that. And then that criticism gets criticized so that you evolve towards something. The problem with the history of the field, particularly SETI, is that since there was never any support for it or never a lot of support for it, somebody would write a paper like, oh, we should be looking at neutron stars. Somebody, you know, aliens are going to modify neutron stars. And that paper it just sat there forever. And nobody ever got a chance to really work on it. Now what's happening is we're being able to do, the field is maturing, and we're able to address the question of false positives. How would you know whether or not the thing you think is a bio signature or a techno signature is actually something that was produced in a way that had nothing to do with life or nothing to do with intelligence. And so that is a fascinating part of the field now. And in a lot of cases, it's going to rely on Bayesian methods, right? So this idea of understanding what your priors are, like, oh, here's some evidence, but, you know, how does this evidence update what I already thought was going to be a techno signature? And part of that means context, right? You know, as Sarah Walker likes to say, I think she's one of the great physicists thinking about life in general right now. A molecule is not a biosignature or a technosignature, right? One single thing does not constitute like, oh, we found it. So for example, let me give you an example. Our group wrote a paper where we looked at chlorofluorocarbons as a technosignature, right? We now have the capacity, even JWST might be able to do this. We can look into an alien atmosphere, look at the light that passes from the star through the atmosphere, reaches us, and there'll be a spectral imprint. If chlorofluorocarbons are there, we'll be able to tell. We'll be able to see the fingerprint, the spectral fingerprint of that. Now, as far as we know, chlorofluorocarbons cannot be produced anyway by nature. You have to have industrial processes to make them. So on one hand, it's like, that's it. If you find a chlorofluorocarbons, you found a technosignature. Okay, wait, we shouldn't be so, you know, a molecule is not a technosignature. Now you got to look at let's look at the other things that are happening on that planet. What's its atmosphere like? You know, what's the state of it? What's temperature? It's pressure. What else can we tell about the atmosphere? Does the planet seem to have water on it? So it's going to be, you know, in order to really know, we're going to have to put together all the other things we know about the planet in order to really, really be confident. So we'll make the detection. We'll be super excited. And then we're going to keep raising the level of our confidence by looking at other aspects of it as well.
So, I mean, we're talking about the frontiers here. So, I mean, we've had a massive explosion of new exoplanets. We have these new instruments like the James Webb that give us a lot more data to use. We're also getting a lot more just from Earth, as you said, in your different revolutions, where we're understanding more of the evolution, how life affects the planet itself. I'm curious, like, you know, a lot of our shows focus on AI. And so using all this data, dumping it into an LLM, a large language model, and sort of processing what we're seeing, when I hear you talk about technosignatures and you're like, look, we've got millions of exoplanets, we have these spectral imprints that you're pulling in from every single one of them, what I go through my head is like, well, this is just kind of pattern recognition. I hear Bayesian, or almost to probabilistic graph models. Is AI in any way kind of influencing this field, given kind of the data surface that's sort of coming out from all these different instruments?
Oh, God, absolutely. I mean, you look at the Kepler data. One of the reasons why Kepler has discovered so many exoplanets is they have a pipeline. The Kepler satellite mission finds exoplanets by looking for what are called transits, which are like little mini eclipses. The planet, you know, if the alignment of the orbit is right, then once every orbit, the planet passes between us and its host star. And when it passes in front, the light dims a little bit. And there's a very characteristic way in which, you know, kind of makes a U-shape in the brightness. If you're looking at the brightness over time, the star is bright, and then it dims a little bit in this U-shaped way and then comes back. And so there's a lot of information in the shape of that U. And so, you know, the Kepler, in order because it had to sort through so many, has an automated pipeline. And then also every now and then, right, it finds things it didn't understand. And then it, you know, sort of vomits it up and says, hey, human being, you figure this out. And that's how we discovered what's called Bajoyan star, which had this really weird non-periodic, strange signal, which some people took to being alien megastructures. One, you know, so it looked like something was just bunch of stuff was just passing, giant stuff was just passing in front of the star, and then nothing, and then like three of them going by and nothing. And that was a really interesting moment, because when they were analyzing it, one of the possibilities they had to consider that it was alien megastructures. Who doesn't like to say the word alien megastructure? So anyway, so it turns out, sorry, it's not alien megastructures, it's comets. But the important thing is that in all of these domains, we're going to have to search through so much data that AI is going to be an absolute, and machine learning is going to be a really, really important component of this.
And you know, the follow-up question to that is, obviously, we're searching for stuff that we think exists. So you're sort of getting this in one of your earlier answers, which, you know, we have carbon-based life forms, we're looking for certain signatures, we're expecting a certain level of culture. We're not going to find a poem, but we're going to find certain technologies. It could be radio frequencies that aren't naturally occurring, but would only occur if you had electronics or transistors or specific inventions along the course. How easy is it to be open to new forms of life, right? So we see what is available on our own planet, what we've discovered throughout the solar system. But, you know, being extremely open-ended, what are sort of the constraints? Can we actually come up with like physical rules? Like life cannot exist if it has a certain chemicals. I'm curious, like, how do you keep that openness alive in these searches? Because we sort of have our priors, but then there's just sort of this open-ended, like maybe it is an alien megastructure or maybe it's something else. How do you balance that with the kind of rigors of science and not conspiratorial, you know, of entering the, you know, everything is possible and there's no rigor to it whatsoever.
Well, that's the joy of this field, right? Again, you know, after years of like not even being able to talk about it, now I think one of the most important things we can do is begin to systematize the process, right? To begin to, you know, really understand what we know and what we don't know. And if we want to go beyond sort of Earth's history, how do we do it in a way that, you know, like when you were a kid and you were bowling and they had the gutters that would come up so the ball didn't roll in, that we are, you know, we need to have our bowling gutters up. And there's a bunch of different ways they can do this. The first thing is just like this systemization of just sort of really saying, okay, let's run through all the ideas and let's see where we can begin to have kind of consistency checks, you know, for it. But I think one, like when it comes to just life in general, not just techno signatures, what's really interesting now is to think about life in is not just what happened on Earth, but in general, what is life? What does life do, right? What is the physics of life that might leave signatures? So one of the thing is, you know, so I'm working on this. We have a Templeton grant, big Templeton grant, to look at it, life as a system that uses information. The interesting thing about life is that it's the only physical system that uses information. Rock, you know, you can describe a rock or a star, you know, you can describe the nuclear reaction network in a star in terms of information, but you don't have to. It's not a, you know, it doesn't, you don't really gain anything. Whereas life is the one system that actually uses information, meaning it stores, it copies, it transports, and it processes information. So we have a big grant right now that's trying to look, you know, understanding what that means, particularly about semantics, right? You know, because as you know, Shannon information, all of our stuff is built on Shannon or syntactic information. And syntactic information is just surprise, right? It's just, you know, oh, I have, you know, 89 E's and now I got an A and I'm a surprise and that carries information. But really, you know, truly information, all information is really semantic information. It carries meaning for somebody, right? Because you can't have surprise unless you have a detector for detecting that string, right? So already, you know, the system has to have organized itself to have a detector for the thing it wants to be surprised by. So there is no purely syntactic information. So information is always, you know, is information only matters when there's already a detector set up by the thing that's trying to stay alive to use that information to stay alive for. So what that means is that, you know, if you have these kinds of definitions, these sort of information-based, network-based, far from equilibrium, thermodynamic system-based definitions of life, now you may have things that it doesn't matter about Earth life. It doesn't matter about carbon or water. You may be able to find ways of looking for life in terms of its information, its networked information use, where it's drawing energy from some source to maintain its far from equilibrium state and therefore creating dissipation. So, you know, these are all these other kind of like physics, information, network theory based ways of looking for life that really are agnostic about what exact form it takes, whether it has two legs, you know, two arms and a head. So I find some of that stuff, as a physicist, a theoretical physicist, the most fascinating ways of looking for it. So just to be explicit, like maybe we're going to look at an atmosphere and we're going to be able to look not just for one spectral line due to a molecule, but we're going to look for like three or four molecules and we're going to look at how much there is of each one of those. We're going to try and reconstruct the chemical network of reactions between those. And from that, we might be able to be like, oh, okay, this kind of chemical network would never be randomly assembled. This is something that has to come either from biology with its purpose driven, it's viability driven impetus, or technology where there's not only viability, you know, not only does it need to stay alive, there's an actual goal in mind. So that may be the way that we go past sort of getting fooled.
You know, going back to your book, I'm curious. I mean, obviously there's just surprise galore across this entire field. There's always new learning. I mean, it's one of those fields is so open-ended because it's unconstrained. It's sort of a search problem. But I'm curious if there are particular surprises that you've come up with in your career and in this field that just really shocked you in terms of its value or what you know its value has been for the science.
Yeah, again and again. I mean, look, the first and most important one was that we're weird. The solar system is not the average by any stretch of the imagination, is not the average solar system, right? This idea, you know, we learn in school, there's like the inner solar system with its tidy little rocky planets, and then there's the outer solar system with its big gas giants. No, like, you know, you have lots of worlds where you've got gas giants close to the star, very close to the star. The most common type of planet in the universe we don't even have in our solar system. It's a either what we call super Earths or sub Neptunes. These are planets between one Earth mass and one Uranus mass, right? And because on the solar system, so that's one Earth mass, and Uranus is like 14 or so, 14, 17, Uranus and Neptune, 14, 17. So in our solar system, there's nothing in between that. Mm. That it's exactly in that valley, that, you know, that desert, that's where all the other planets are, most of the other planets. So there, right there, there's that incredible surprise. We are the weirdos. And then it's like recently, just like, you know, this last year, the what are called Hycean worlds. There was the JWST was able to find, by characterizing the atmosphere, by telling what was in the atmosphere of this planet, I think it's K2-18b, that this was likely what's called a Hycean world, hydrogen ocean world, that had only been proposed like maybe 2 years ago. And what's amazing about it, it is a giant world. It's like eight times the Earth, size of Earth. And it's got a huge hydrogen atmosphere. Like our atmosphere is this little onion skin, right? This would be a huge atmosphere. And that hydrogen atmosphere warms the planet up so that there's a liquid ocean. There looks like there's a good odds there's a giant liquid ocean on it, warm. And so great place for life to form. And so this is an entirely new class of habitable zone world. You know, the habitable zone, which is, you know, where the zone where you can have liquid water on the surface of a planet, goes back to 1958. That idea was proposed, right? And so it's always been for rocky worlds and, you know, and it's the basis of so much of our science. And here we just discovered this entirely new class of habitable world, looked on nothing like the ones we thought about. And because of the hydrogen is so good as a blanket for warming things up, its habitable zone is way different than the habitable zone you'd come up with for Earth-like planets. So, you know, all the time, every day, there are new stunning discoveries that are really force you to change your thinking about, you know, what you think is possible.
All right, so we have this huge explosion. We've seen more habitable zones. We see super Earths. We're learning kind of our little place in the world. But this brings up this question of the Fermi paradox, which you cover in the book quite a lot. Which is this kind of mismatch between the fact that we now know there are, you know, thousands plus exoplanets all around the Milky Way and other galaxies, et cetera. We're finding that many of them could potentially host life, either because they're in habitable zones or they have signatures, technosignatures or biosignatures that could potentially host life. And yet we haven't found it yet. And this paradox between there's so much probability that one of these should host it, and yet we sort of lack the conclusive evidence that one exists. How do we sort of address that in 2024, given all the information we've gotten over the last two decades?
Yeah, as I like to say, there is no Fermi paradox, at least the kind of one that people often think about, right? So when Fermi proposed, and he went, you know, it was literally like a joke over lunch, but the traditional Fermi paradox, or what I call the direct Fermi paradox, goes like this. Look, if there is another civilization which can travel between the stars, develops the will and the technology to travel between the stars, even slower than the speed of light, then, you know, on a time scale shorter than the age, much shorter than the age of the galaxy, it could hop between stars and set up colonies, you know, and spread across the entire galaxy. So with that Fermi paradox is the question is, why aren't they here now, right? That is a very different question from why we've looked and we haven't found out there. And so let's put the direct Fermi paradox to the side for a second and talk about the one that most people think about, which is what you're talking about, the indirect Fermi paradox. We've been looking for 50 years and we haven't found anything. No, we haven't, because there's never been any money to look, right? People have this idea that every night astronomers take their telescopes and they point them to the stars and they search for alien signals. And the fact is that there's never been any funding to do that. So Jason Wright, one of my colleagues, based on a suggestion by Jill Tarter, did this great project. It was a student project where they took all the SETI searches that have ever been done and they added them all up and they tried to figure out how much of the parameter space that had actually been looked at. So if you think of the sky as an ocean that we have to search and we're looking for fish, how much SETI searching have we done? And it turns out we've looked at a hot tub, right? You know, you think of the entire ocean. And what we've done so far is we've looked at a hot tub's worth of water. We haven't found any fish in that hot tub. Should we now say like, well, that's it. There's no fish in the ocean, right? So there's just no Fermi paradox, not the indirect one. Now, the direct one, why aren't they here now? You know, if you're a UFO person, you're like, well, they are here now. You know, I'm not really bothered by that one as much because there's a zillion ways out of it. You know, interstellar travel may be very, very difficult. And it may be so difficult that people just don't want to do it very much. And not only that, we wrote a long paper on this. We did computer simulations of the Milky Way. And we did find, like, yes, the settlement front expands across the galaxy very quickly. But, you know, civilizations don't last forever, right? I mean, based on Earth history, they don't last forever, which means if somebody arrived 2 billion years ago, right, why not? 2 billion years ago, and they lasted for like 10,000 years, which would be a long time by what we know, there'd be no record of them, right? This is a paper I wrote with Gavin Schmidt about the Silurian hypothesis. After like 2 million years, the Earth's surface is completely reworked via, you know, various kinds of processes. There would be zero evidence except maybe in strata, isotopic records in strata. So, you know, there's no way to know whether they visited a billion, you know, this Earth's history is pretty long. So unless they literally visited, you know, 20 seconds ago, you wouldn't really know about it. So I don't find there's so many ways around the real Fermi paradox, the direct Fermi paradox, that I'm not bothered by it. And there is no other Fermi. And the thing is, finally, this is the whole point of the book, is that finally we can look. Finally, we have the ways to look and there's going to be the funding to look.
Well, then let's dive into that. I mean, this is a great topic. So 2024, we've sort of opened up the what's called Pandora's box or whatever you want to call it. But we're really opening it all up. We're making a ton of discoveries. You know, what are the frontiers here? What kind of sciences are coming to the table? What kind of communities are sort of joining around this effort? You know, what governments are putting the money here? Where are sort of the hubs of it? Where is sort of the vitality of the field today in 2024?
Well, in 2020, every 10 years, the entire world astronomy community gets together and produces these things called the decadal reports, where, you know, everybody gets together and decides what are the most pressing issues, where should the money be spent for the next generation of instruments? Because, you know, science requires a lot of planning, right? You can't just like, and this is the thing people don't understand about, like, you can't cut the budget on, you know, U.S. science, you know, for 3 years in a row and expect like, oh, don't worry, we'll put it back later on. You know, you've got to be thinking two decades ahead. So, but the important thing about that was one of the primary problems that, you know, the astronomers identified the most important problem, or at least one of the most important problems, to be the search for life. So that means, and that's where that's why the Habitable Worlds Observatory was chosen as NASA's next big flagship project. So there is lots of effort going on, everything from using ground-based telescopes now to search the skies for biosignatures. There is the JWST, which is just at the hairy edge. The JWST could potentially, if we're lucky, find a biosignature or a technosignature. There's lots of funding for thinking about, you know, developing new theoretical models for understanding. That's what we're getting paid to do. Our job is to come up with a library of technosignatures that could, we're not going to search, but we're going to give the observers the tools and the that they need to, you know, the library of here's the things you should look for. So, and then also part of this community is this, we're getting biologists involved because with Mars, going to Titan, there's all these places, there's the ocean moons of Jupiter and Saturn. There's places in the solar system where we could really be looking for microbial life or even something more interesting, like in those subsurface oceans of the big moons of Jupiter and Saturn. So it's a interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary field that now is very, very vibrant with new technologies being developed. Real technological, technology-driven, experimental programs being carried out right now. So, you know, my thing, as I said in the book, is that in the next 10, 20 or 30 years, I would say, I feel very confident that we're going to have actual data relevant to this question. I can't tell you what it's going to say, but after, you know, this people have been arguing about this for 2,500 years. You can see the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, yelling at each other about whether or not there's life and other life in the universe. And after 2,500 years of yelling at each other over their opinions, man, you know, or occasionally setting each other on fire over them, Giordano Bruno, we're finally going to have facts, actual data. And it's just, it's, you know, and this is the most important question in human history. There's nothing, I think, more important. Are we alone? Are we an accident? Are we the only time this has happened, life in the entire universe? Yeah, it's like there are so many frontiers and they're being pushed hard by so many people. It's really exciting.
You know, we're closing out the show here, but I have two questions. One of which, when will we find life? Do you have a prediction of a date? Is that a fun parlor game for astrophysicists in your community? And maybe an easier question is, what's sort of the next big milestone that the public should look for from the field?
Okay, well, I predict that we're going to find life like a month before I die, so that for sure I get to know about it. So I don't care when we find it, just as long as I'm still around and cognizant. No, I can't make, you know, I don't know. I think, like I said, we're going to have data relevant to it within, I absolutely predict that we're going to have like data that we can start digging into and inferring either life or like, oh, actually life is hard to, you know, make that. That's coming for sure in the next 30 years. That's what I would argue. And the next big thing, I think people should just be, you know, listen, we could discover life next week, right? I mean, so, you know, but they should follow the progress we're making in characterizing these exoplanets. So particular, I think the thing people really want to look for is atmospheres. This is really the frontier, is understanding, learning how to characterize atmospheres of exoplanets. First of all, finding atmospheres. Do we have, you know, as we start to look at Earth-like worlds, we don't really have an example yet. Well, we may have one of atmospheres, of viable atmospheres. So I think that's really kind of the next science. That's the area I'm most interested in following. But people should just keep their ears out. We're going to be, there's just, you know, I think, you know, every few months, you're probably going to see something, some discovery that's really relevant to this question that will be mind-blowing in its own way.
Well, that's incredible. Adam Frank, the author of The Little Book of Aliens, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a great pleasure. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you.